Welcome to Bergonomics, demystifying economics with Ross McDowell.
Hi, I'm Ross McDowell. Welcome to Bergonomics, the podcast that demystifies economics, applying it to your everyday life. Today's topic is petrol prices. Are you being taken for a ride? Every day when driving our cars, we pass lots of petrol stations, all displaying electronic pricing boards that give the impression each petrol retailer is adjusting prices to get your business. The pricing boards give the appearance of a lively, competitive marketplace for retail petrol. But is it? When researching today's podcast on petrol, I contacted several economists, including Professor Ian Harper, who chaired the 2015 Australian Competition Policy Review, which examined, amongst other things, whether petrol was being priced legally in Australia. All the economists I contacted agree the gentleman sitting opposite me is the ultimate expert on petrol pricing, and that gentleman is David Byrne, Professor of Economics at Melbourne University. David, welcome to the Bergonomics podcast.
It's great to be here, Ross.
It would take up the whole podcast if I were to list all the academic papers and media contributions you've made regarding anti-commercial competitive behaviour in Australia. But the one I want to concentrate on today is a study you authored with Professor Nicholas de Roos of the University of Sydney called Learning to Coordinate, a Study in Gasoline. Your study concluded that there was some form of interrelationship between petrol pricing as it appears at the pump.
Yep.
And in it, you say that you mention a company and their price leadership in petrol retailing and their experiments in pricing appear to have facilitated a mutual understanding among rivals of a new profit-enhancing focal pricing structure.
Yep.
So before we talk specifically about your findings in that study and how you went about it, did you produce the study because you thought that petrol pricing in terms of what the public were paying, that, well, the public was being taken for a ride?
So a bit of background. I've worked on price-fixing cases in retail gasoline, or petrol, I'm Canadian, but petrol markets. Dating back, I don't know, 2008, 2009 was the first time I was involved. So I had quite a bit of experience working with petrol data. It's very rich, like the pricing boards you talked about. I was kind of had a feel for that type of data, and I got a feel for sort of how these markets were operating, having done research, you know, for more than a decade on them, up until starting to write that paper. One day, Nicholas de Roos at the University of Sydney, my colleague that's writing all these papers with me, and good friend, he came to me sort of with it's like a dead body. He brought a cadaver and he said, look, I've been looking at margins in Perth, petrol margins, and something weird's happening in 2010. Look at it before 2010, margins are, I don't know, it was 3 or 4 or 5 cents per liter on average relative to this terminal gate price, the wholesale cost that kind of moves over time for the retailers. And then this gap grows. There's this growth between the retail prices go up, but the wholesale costs aren't moving with it, and it seems to stay up. And so that's where it kind of came. It was around 2015. He sort of, yeah, basically it's like, here's a dead body. Should we do an autopsy? If we think about margins just moving up for some reason. And so the good thing about Perth from a research perspective and from being able to have sort of nice petri dishes and a microscope to really look into what went wrong with competition is the market generates from a government platform called Fuel Watch, every single price, every single station sets at every single point in time. We can see everything. And so it's from that point we said, let's kind of look into this and to see what's happened here. And why did those prices all of a sudden start to jump around 2010 and have stayed up ever since relative to cost? That's where it started from.
Okay, and so then you decided that you would conduct a study?
Forensic investigation is one way we've kind of often talked about it, right?
Okay, so you're going to be able to empirically prove your conclusions?
We were going to try to solve the murder mystery, right? That's kind of what we were going to get into is, okay, we're looking at monthly prices, and that's the sort of usual thing we can see when we look at margins in any market. We can look at like average price and average cost and see how those are moving kind of over time. What we were able to do with Perth was start to look at like individual station level daily high frequency prices to really zoom in around when these prices started to take off. Was anything happening, you know, between individual players in the market? So we're talking British Petroleum or BP, Caltex, Coles and Woolworths, who run 60 to 70% of all the stations in that market, right? Were they doing things at very high frequencies that you can't see, you know, you can't see it in the monthly data, but if I look at the daily data, the interactions between the stations each day, could we start to see things there that look kind of not competitive or things that would have potentially facilitated this shift to, you know, a higher price equilibrium that they were able to get to? And so we looked into that, and yes, we found some very peculiar behavior.
Okay, so let's talk about your definition of very peculiar behavior.
Sure.
What would you call very peculiar behavior? We'll go back to exactly what you did.
Sure.
But in Australia, we have legislation that prohibits a whole range of practices that are deemed to be anti-competitive.
Yes.
And since 1965, we've enhanced the legislation to protect consumers against having to pay too much or any anti-competitive.
So
what were the practices that you were concerned about that may have been occurring in that market?
Yeah, so one thing we had sort of noticed was, let me just step back and talk about how prices behave in Perth, but also in every other price in a petrol market in Australia, the major cities especially. In the urban centers, we see these cycles in prices. They go up and they go down. They go up and they go down. Okay? So there's high price days and low price days. In Perth, prior to 2010, when did the high price days occur in the market? They sort of happened 2009, 2010. They happened kind of all throughout the week. Sometimes, some weeks it would be Sunday was the high price day. Some days Monday would be, Wednesday, Friday. It would be sort of mixed. And the companies that would be the first to move up kind of happened with everybody. Every station was sometimes the higher guy. And then the higher price station would go up and the rest of the market would follow. And then it would teeter back down. And then the prices would go up again on some other day by some other station later in. We started to see around April 2009, we looked at this. All of a sudden, Thursday became the magical jump day. Thursday. And that was pretty interesting. It went from being mixed to every day Thursday. You know, why Thursday? Wholesale costs aren't doing anything differently on Thursday. They just picked, there's this magical Thursday day. That's what we call, we call it a focal pricing equilibrium. So this was one of the focal points. Thursday, we all go up together. So now, you know, think about it, Ross. We're across the street from each other, and some days you go up and I go down, and it's kind of noisy. And then all of a sudden we realize, okay, Thursday is our day, mate, where we're going to increase our prices, okay? It becomes easier to kind of coordinate, anticipate what we're going to do with each other if everybody's working on Thursday. So that's when we're starting to, you know, narrow that microscope with that rich data. We start to see it goes from every day of the week to Thursday becomes a magic day. We look a little further, and we started to see actually, that's kind of like on average for the whole market. But BP was actually going up on Wednesdays. So BP's Wednesday, rest of the market Thursday, Wednesday, Thursday, Wednesday, Thursday. And BP would set prices on Wednesdays that the whole market, you'd be shocked to hear, matched on Thursday. And so BP had established itself by repeatedly moving all its prices up for its whole station network on Wednesdays, and the market would just follow. And so once BP knows everybody just follows them, BP is in the driver's seat. They basically get to say, right, let's just go up whatever price we want on Wednesday. We know you're all going to follow. The more we go up, the more we all make. And so we call that price leadership. And so we saw this very stark form of regular price leadership emerge in 2009, 2010, that in a way that BP was able to cement itself as the leader. And so you get this leader-follower thing happening every week. And then it's part of the job at that point is easy for BP. Right, increase the price on Wednesday, and whatever we set, the market will determine. They could orchestrate the market. So we've often talked about it was as if BP was like the conductor and the market was the orchestra. They were kind of orchestrating where prices would go every Thursday. That doesn't take any phone calls. That doesn't take any messages. That just, we're going to increase. And if we just do this regularly every week, we can all kind of settle into a routine of up on, we'll watch you go up on Wednesday, and everybody else will go up on Thursday. And so we saw that. That was one big part of it that was, it's just an artificial price increase. We couldn't understand on Thursdays for no cost or demand related reasons why prices would go up.
Why do you think they chose Thursday or Wednesday?
Yeah, I mean, they've changed it over time. They did that for 5 or 6 years, and then it went to Wednesday for some years and Tuesdays for some years. I don't know if the day of the week so much matters as that there is a regular day of the week. So I think that's kind of the key thing is that there's a... So why do we want a regular day of the week? So one thing is it's easy for all those players in the market to just know that's the it's Thursday. The other thing is, prior to them creating the focal day, this Thursday day, the magic day that all the prices go up, the way they used to price petrol is when these jumps would irregularly happen, everybody would cut prices in between these jumps, that cycle I was telling you about. And we'd increase price, and then it's like a war would start. We'd all increase prices, and we'd keep doing that until we went down to wholesale cost. Then we'd go back up again. When we do this magical Wednesday thing in Perth, what was happening is we were limiting how much undercutting would occur. This is going to be the second part of the focal rule. BP not only helped implement Thursdays as the magic day to increase prices, but they also implemented a second focal rule. We document in the paper. They created what we call 2 cent per liter price cuts. Every day between those jumps, you'd cut 2 cents, like a stair step. 2 cent, 2 cent, 2 cent, 2 cent, 2 cent. You'd do that for 6 days, then we'd go back up. If we just say there's 6 days and 2 cents each day, that limits price undercutting to 12 cents per liter between the jumps. So what you're able to do then if you're BP is say, right, we're gonna make sure we never price down to cost. We'll just keep the undercutting under control, right? There's 6 days of it between the Thursdays, 2 cents per liter per day. The market followed that focal rule as well. And then we'll just increase prices on Wednesday. The market will follow our signal on the Thursday. And so what we know now, this is how the two focal pricing rules work in tandem. BP, then all you got to do is increase your margins on Thursday. Everybody follows. And then we'll cut prices by 12 cents per liter in between. But the average price is higher. We're now no longer cutting prices down to cost. We're restraining the amount of competitive pressure in the market, the willingness to price, right? Because those firms are willing to potentially compete for customers,
sure,
undercutting the low cost, but that wasn't the norm. That's not what the focal rules were doing. So that's what we kind of established in the market. And we also further found there was a time when Caltex wasn't agreeing to the Thursday increases. They were doing Fridays. And BP was doing Wednesday increases, and everybody would start following Caltex to the Fridays. Caltex wasn't playing nice. And BP then decided, they did it, this disc coordination happened for a few months in 2009, 2010. And BP basically in the data we show said, right, let's all try not having price increases for a month, December 2009. We'll just stop leading the market. Let's just price low. Let's see how we all feel about that.
So when you say,
yeah,
let's see how we all feel about that.
Yeah, yeah.
They were having that conversation with themselves in their own office. They weren't having that conversation with their competitors.
No, but they would basically, it was clear in the market, again, using the hyper-rich data we have, we can see all this, that there was this leader-follower dynamic, and Caltex was being a bit cheeky, if you will. They were delaying the following. We're not going to follow on Thursday. We'll follow on Friday. And now BP's really high, and Caltex is stealing business like crazy. And so BP then spent a month not leading. They just said, right, we'll just pull the plug on this. We'll just price chaotically, and we'll just see how we all go. And margins fall because there's no coordination. Price cutting starts taking off, getting closer to cost. There's no big price increases. None of the other little players know what to do. They're an orchestra without their conductor. They're just making noise, right? And then in 2010, BP starts signaling, let's try this again, right? And so through the lens of an economic model and our core, what we found fascinating with that as researchers is in the field of industrial organization, which is the study of market power in economics, we call that punishment. When you have leaders that are trying to enforce in economic terms, make this distinction clear. This is not a legal discussion, mm-hmm, strictly in terms of economic theory and economic, mm-hmm, models. If I want to price above competitive levels, a key thing I need to do to stop my competitors from undercutting me and screwing up our collusive agreement is I need to be able to threaten. If you don't agree, I'll punish you.
So hang on. So yeah. What you're saying here is they've set up a pattern of behavior without direct communication that people follow to the day.
Yes.
And it is so entrenched in terms of the petrol companies and your study about when they increased and decreased their behavior.
Yes.
That they followed that so rigidly that put everybody other than BP, the price leader, in a position where they could be punished.
If they didn't play nice.
If they didn't continue to price according to these cycles, BP would use their market power.
Their leadership role, market power,
to punish those that weren't following their price increases and decreases.
Yeah, that they weren't following, let's call them the rules. These are all tacit, silent rules, but the norms.
Yeah.
Right? And that's perfectly consistent with theories of tacit collusion in economics.
Yeah.
That if you don't follow by the rules, we'll punish. As researchers, as scientists, we were fascinated. We never get to see punishment in the field. We just don't see it. And we saw that. Oh my God, they're doing it. They're doing what the theory says they should do. Right? The theory is very mafia-like. Right? It's like, we're going to run this neighborhood and you should play by our rules. And it would be a shame if something happened to your knees if you didn't follow by the rules. It is very, the way we think about cartels and collusion in economic theory is just like out of The Sopranos. And we were seeing something that was consistent with that in the field in Perth. And the reason we could see it, right, coming back to the cadaver and trying to figure out why things weren't working there in terms of margins and why they're taking off, is we had that hyper-rich data and we could see exactly when the other players stopped playing by the rules, according to the norms, and when BP took action for a month to just say, right, let's just blow this up and see how we all feel about this.
Okay.
After coming out of that, we would sometimes call that a price war.
Yep.
That conflict period, BP then in 2010 started to reinitiate the cycle of we increase Wednesday, you guys follow Thursday, we'll only cut 2 cents per liter per day between the Thursdays, and we can increase margins overall. And so BP used experiments and signals through the prices in the market to reestablish that cyclical behavior. Then we found something else out. I'm happy to go on further about it, but and this is going to bring in a separate issue though, separate from...
Okay. Before you do that, let me just ask you one thing.
Sure.
So you've talked about competitive behavior, increasing, decreasing.
Yeah.
We exist in a market capitalist economy.
Yeah.
Market forces, this magic phrase, market forces and the profit motive is meant to determine and govern a whole lot of activity.
Absolutely.
And so therefore, if I was in a market such as petrol and I wanted to increase my market share, I would think about a couple of things. I would increase my advertising budget to say my petrol's better than everybody else.
Right.
And at the same time, I might decrease the retail cost of my petrol.
Yep.
So then people driving around would go, well, I'm not buying that petrol, it's too expensive.
Yes.
I'll go and buy this petrol.
Yes.
Therefore, they take all of their business, fill up their cars at the cheaper petrol.
Yep.
The person with the more expensive petrol doesn't sell as much.
Yep.
Therefore, his profit margin drops.
Yep.
And that's a market efficiently working.
Yes.
In this case,
yes,
you've got BP that are setting the marketplace.
Yes.
Why didn't people, why didn't management sit back and go, okay, increasing advertising budget's not working. Let's just continuously cut price until we take off enough business or these people, it hurts them so much, BP, that we can maintain some of those customers and retain our profitability.
Yep.
Why didn't the market forces in that psychological scenario work?
Yep. I think there's two countervailing forces at play there. So one is you have these small asymmetric competitors in the market, these independent stations, and they always have, and they do in the data, they always undercut the bigger brands. So if you're Caltex, you might think, let's undercut BP a bit, steal some market. The second you do that, you're going to see, first of all, BP will price match you. You haven't gained anything. And on top of that, you've kind of spurred the little guys to cut. They're like, oh, they're okay, we're cutting. Let's go. Let's keep stealing. And so if we all know when we undercut that we're all going to match and go lower, you quickly end up in a race to the bottom, right? Because where do you stop? Where do you draw the line? That's when we start pricing towards marginal cost. That's exactly what we saw in a world before these focal rules took off. So you can choose to go down that path, and that's when the margins are half of what they were after the focal rules came in. Or you can decide to price according to these easily observed focal rules. Increase on Thursday, cut by 2 cents per liter each day. And if we all mutually understand that that keeps in check hyper-competition, which is can potentially take off in this type of market, when petrol stations have big visible boards and people, there's a sub-segment of people that really shop around and the little guys are really trying to get those players, the little independent stations. That's a choice that, particularly if you're four of the stations own 60, 70% of the market, and you know the little guys just kind of follow you and undercut, you can basically make that choice. Let's follow the rules and not end up in that race to the bottom. So I think that that's one choice. You can choose to undercut, but if you know everybody's going to undercut with you, all you've done is reduce your margin and you've stolen no market share. So given that choice, why not just follow the rules? That's one take. And again, our theories of tacit collusion in economics is really about that. We can choose to stay high or we can all fight. And if we all fight, we make no money. And if we know that's what happens, then we'll never get there. We'll just stay high. So that's one problem.
Yep.
The second is a lot of people don't pay attention to petrol prices. You'd be shocked to hear that, you know, in Perth, in separate work I've done with Professor DeRuz, we estimate something like 1 in 5 people shop with their online petrol price platform, Fuel Watch. It allows you to compare every price on your route everywhere. You can be the hyper-informed consumer looking around. But the problem is, I think, is people are busy and you have a commuting route. You're not that attentive as you might think you are, as people would be to petrol prices. And, you know, surveys from the ACCC suggest people fill up once a week. A lot of people have norms in shopping called fill up when empty, but that can happen all kinds of times during the day. And so you might think we can undercut and steal a whole bunch of business, but I think in these markets, there's two segments. There's people who are, we might call them shoppers, and then there's the fill up when emptyers. That's like my mom. Mm-hmm. I mean, even I fill up when empty, and I've been studying these things for 15 or 20 years, these markets, right? Life's hard, it's complicated, I can't coordinate optimal petrol price shopping when I gotta pick up the kids, get the grocery, get to work, blah, 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 right? And so even if you undercut and think, let's steal some market, there's a certain degree of market ignorance in the market on the demand side. But it's rational ignorance. We're busy. Mm-hmm. People are busy. That you're not gonna steal as much as you want. Put another way, if everybody was hyper attuned to the price cycle, everybody would, with that Thursday up and right, because Thursday's the high price day, Wednesday was always the day where you could find some low price stations, everybody in Perth should have bought on Wednesday. Yet we show in our research and the appendix and stuff, they're still buying throughout the entire week. So I think that the thing about it is people are aware that there's a cycle. Some people are aware, but not everybody. And so that underlines the gains to that competition and the undercutting you're talking about.
So if I look at the data which says that on average, mm-hmm. people are using 35 litres of fuel per week in their car.
Yep.
Their monthly cost was $140 before the price of fuel went up to nearly $300 a month is what they're using in fuel costs currently.
Yep.
Would any of those figures change if your marketplace that you've described was different? I guess what I'm trying to ask you is,
yep.
you've described a certain way that a market's functioning.
Yes.
And you're saying that it's led by a large company and others follow, and they're doing this for reasons of making a margin so that their companies are profitable, but they're doing it in a somewhat different way than other markets. Let's say the milk market.
Right.
If they were to stop these practices,
yep.
would they be as profitable
yep.
as they are now?
Yeah, so milk's a good example. I don't have high frequency milk pricing data, but consider a market that has what we would say is like cost plus pricing. So retail prices just move with costs and they go by, there's some markup to cover the company's costs and that sort of thing. So you've just asked the $1 million question, as I would expect. on the research side of that, that's a massive question that people are currently trying to figure out. In the absence of cyclical pricing in petrol, which we see in Australia and around the world, would margins be lower? We don't have a definitive answer on that, to be honest. You could imagine worlds where you're BP and you try to coordinate the market on cost plus pricing as opposed to these cycles. Some of the evidence that's out there suggests those small independents, if you tried to do cost plus, they would shave your plus and steal market, and eventually you're getting really squeezed on the margins. It's true in the markets we have studied where you see, you know, cycles get manipulated with price leadership and these sorts of things. And as the price leadership becomes more stark, like in our paper, when the norms emerge and the leadership becomes stronger, profit margins increase by 100% relative to pre-coordinated pricing behavior, right? If we think of competitions a little less coordinated, a little more go get them aggressiveness, and then we think about what we saw in Perth as coordinated, you know, folks in Perth are paying, according to our estimates within, you know, this was over 2010 to 2015, they're all paying, just because of coordination, an additional 5 cents per liter every time they go to the pump.
Okay, so you're saying in a market that's not really a free market,
yeah,
they're paying more.
In a market where the firms aren't ruthlessly, aggressively undercutting each other, and there's a leader and follower, and they have norms with pricing like we've seen here, but we've seen these in other markets. This isn't just a phenomenon in petrol. There's examples of this in wholesale electricity market, online advertising. Like there's many environments. The reason why we see it a lot, we study it in petrol, is because we have the data to really see it, right? But so when we have this leader-follower dynamic and you have these dominant players that can orchestrate the rest of the market, yes, you can get additional, we're seeing in our paper at least, additional margins above and beyond what was being found before the leadership became very entrenched. Right, so there's this market power inflation of 5 cents per liter. Now, is that a lot? You're filling up a 50 liter tank. It's $2.50 every time you go to the Bowser. $2.50, but that's 52 weeks of the year. It's $100. It's more than that probably because you're gonna fill up more in the holidays. Like, they're kind of taking a grocery bill from you, and that's just one person. And then you multiply this by millions of people. These are big bucks quite quickly, right? Mm. So these numbers are not small. These are large profit increases, and they reflect, you know, companies taking advantage of their relative size, their dominance in the market, to be able to orchestrate it and move pricing to something that is quite coordinated. If every petrol station in our example in Perth was owned by just one person, I had one, you had one, everybody, all of our friends had one, we tried to coordinate, we couldn't see each other, it'd be chaos.
But that's okay.
That's competition.
That's fantastic.
That's what we want.
That's what we want.
We want somebody to go out there and try, oh, I'm going to undercut these guys and look, get a bit more market. And then Ross is like, well, I'm going to give that a go too. I can get from you. And then you get that what you're talking about, that competitive outcome,
okay,
right? That we're just, all we're trying to do in the market is the best we can,
okay,
given what people do.
Let me ask you this question.
Sure.
So if we went to the chaos theory where every man and his dog owned a petrol station and were driving around looking at their competitors' prices and adjusting theirs accordingly to meet the market, would there be enough profit margin in the petroleum industry to support the infrastructure within the industry of exploration and refining, or would that diminish? Because, I mean, in Australia, we have this fantastic habit of, we want to have exactly the same, how can I describe it, choice in automotive products, supermarket products, etc., as the rest of the world, and I guess we use the United States as being the example of that.
Yep.
Yet we are a country that is a lot smaller numerically in terms of population, and geographically we're spread out everywhere, and you could never expect with those two factors for us to be able to profitably run the similar sort of services and produce the same products as maybe the United States or countries in Europe.
Yep.
So if we were to have a fantastic free market without these anti-competitive practices, would it generate enough profit to keep the large petroleum companies invested in Australia?
Yeah, because at the end of the day, we all need petrol to get around. So there's a bigger question here about how much do we need petrol? We need it. Now, the question is, how much competition is there for our business, you know, between two different petrol retailers, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But, and so, you know, I think if we had the insane, everybody owns one station, we compete like crazy, and we that reduce margins, in the long run, you'd probably have fewer stations, right? Because there's lower, and probably it'd be more like those stations that are not on main transportation routes, right? So we would get maybe fewer stations, but more efficiently located stations, or the ones that are on the kind of the densely populated commuting routes would emerge. So you'd still have, you know, stations serving the market in the most dense parts of it, in parts of an urban area or in a city. Maybe you'd have a few less on the periphery. Much of the margin is made actually upstream when we go from looking at crude oil prices to wholesale. So it's really coming from where we go from refining to wholesaling. That's where the big margins are. We don't have any data to really tell you how big those margins are. Mm-hmm. Right? These are you know, our major refiners, the BPs, those kind of players, right? That's where the big margins are. The retail margins still matter, still millions of dollars, right?
Sure.
But that's going to be, I think, I would conjecture those are second order to the wholesale market. So the wholesale margins reflect the simple fact that we all need petrol to drive around.
Yep.
And so we would still have a petrol industry. We might have a few, you know, in a hyper-competitive retail market, a few less stations, but we'd still have all the stations, say, on the main routes, kind of competing away for those consumers.
Okay. Now, you did a study, and it was in Perth. Do you believe that basically the same system is operating throughout the country?
Yeah, so Nick DeRuze and I, we've teamed up with Matt Lewis from Clemson, who's the leading petrol researcher in the United States. So we're kind of a research hub on this now. We're looking at that data now for the rest of the country. So I can tell you some preliminary things we see. We do see price leadership.
Price leadership.
Meaning that the players that have large market shares of stations, the BPs, the Caltexes, the Coles, Woolworths, we do see the same sorts of dynamics play out.
Different players in different markets?
Same players across the country playing out in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Brisbane. We do see the same sort of leader-follower behavior. It's not as stark as what was in Perth. Okay, so what we found in Perth was quite stark. Mm-hmm. I think that was partly because in Perth, there's a regulation there under Fuel Watch. They can only set their prices once a day. Mm-hmm. And then it's fixed there for 24 hours to help people be able to shop. The rest of the country, the stations can set their prices whenever they want. So it's more chaotic in that sense. But we still see, it's a messier version of it, but we still see the cycles. We still see the leadership. And we still see the sort of that orchestrator, conductor kind of interaction between the big dominant players and the smaller players. I would add that we've also seen legal matters taken against the bigger players in the market in 2015-16 on a matter called informed sources. I'm not sure if your listeners are aware of this. There's a prior to 2015-16, there was this platform, this online kind of data hub, where at least the big five, so your BP, Caltex, Woolworths, Coles, and 7-Eleven were subscribed to a platform where the stations, those companies were uploading their stations' prices in real time to allow them and each other to watch all of each other's stations' prices across the country. And the ACCC thought this wasn't good. We can all monitor each other like they were doing in Perth, and maybe we're coordinating and things. And so that matter resolved in December 2015, saying informed sources needed to stop just hoarding all the data on the supply side of the market, just amongst the retailers. They had made the data available to the consumers so they could shop. And Coles had to desubscribe from the platform. Like those were, you know, Matt, those were actions taken by the government against those players for information sharing over concerns of tacit collusion and coordination.
How did the government go? Did they win?
It was a settlement. So I don't think they weren't shutting down informed sources. There's nothing per se wrong with sharing information. We observe each other all the time in these markets. They might observe each other looking at each other's stations across the street from each other, and you could argue that's just the, you know, we're using the internet to watch each other. What's wrong with that, right? So they reached basically a settlement. It didn't go to trial or anything like this, where they said, okay, we're not going to stop you from using technology to watch each other in pricing, But you got to make that information available to consumers too. What we call search platforms that help you shop around can emerge, use that data to help people shop. And that did happen as a result of that. So you're trying to balance the scales between the retailers and consumers in terms of how informed they are.
Okay, but you've described a marketplace that's operating that I would think breaks a whole lot of laws in terms of anti-competitive behavior. Not for you to pursue that because you're an economist, but in terms of the ACCC, have they mounted actions against the petrol retailers and distributors on anti-competitive grounds?
So there's historical examples of price fixing cases that the ACCC have taken against players where they've known in the market, they've explicitly communicated with each other. That's illegal. You can't talk to each other and just determine how to set prices. So there's historical examples of that. Where we're in a tricky situation now in petrol markets and many other markets for that matter is this middle ground where I don't have any evidence of us talking to each other. There's no conspiracy. We're not in a smoke-filled room or on a golf course with wiretaps establishing Ross and Dave talked about how to set prices. But there's wink-wink going on in the market. There's mutual understanding arriving. So, we now have these Concerted Practices Act in Australia that says things to the effect of you can't act as if you talked. So that's a recent sort of reform that strengthens the ACCC's ability to come after players for this. Now, have they taken a case in petrol, leveraging that relatively new piece of legislation? No, not to my knowledge.
Why not?
I think the optics are tough for the ACCC in these cases. They're very public. If they're going to go, they better have a strong case to go public with prosecuting the companies, particularly petrol companies, which are very sort of sensitive to everybody because we see them every day and we pay so much money for their services. So I think just there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. I would say that in the first instance. And I think the second thing is when you get into court, you run into the problem of what I would call the counterfactual. The lawyers are going to say, if you didn't do this, it's your question. If you didn't do this, what would you do? Like what's the count? What is the, and as an expert, I've been in these cases on both sides. I've been on the retailer side working for them. I've been on the government side. And you run into a challenge of the counterfactual of, well, what does competition look like? We don't know what it looks like because we've only ever seen pricing in this way. And that so seeds a doubt.
But isn't that the great crux of the problem, what you and I are talking about?
Yeah.
Is that at the beginning, we have a freely operating marketplace. Then we have a dominant player that comes in. He sets a methodology to ensure his and other competitors' profit margins and are healthier.
Yeah.
He does that in maybe an anti-competitive manner. But because he's not immediately prosecuted successfully, and it goes on for such a long time, that becomes the culture of the market. And then the culture of the market just continues to grow out into the other states, maybe even into other markets. But the culture of the petrol market is this cycle of price increases and when they go up and when they go down has been now happening for so long and hasn't been successfully stopped or prosecuted that it's really the petrol wholesalers that are in control.
Let me push back on that in a way that's going to irritate all the listeners.
Mm-hmm.
Let me be the expert on the other side of that.
Mm-hmm.
Ross, we shouldn't hate the players. You can hate the game.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeing with these cycles, it's competition playing out in a world where people don't pay attention to prices. Consumers don't shop aggressively enough to punish high prices. They don't time their purchases to, buy at the low part of the cycle and avoid the high part. What are the if people don't pay attention and people don't time their purchases, why shouldn't the companies take advantage of them? That's just profit maximization in a world with uninformed consumers.
Yep.
I call that competition where I live, right? I mean, that's what kind of comes up, right? I could go further. Are we going to go then charge all the airlines for colluding because people book at the last second and they get exploited? That's competition. That's just you have inelastic demand. You're not price sensitive. I'll charge a higher price and make more money off of you. There's nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly consistent with competition. Yep. And if you get me in court talking about price cycles and coordination, yep, I can come back and say this to you all day long.
Yep.
Now, I'm an economist, so I probably don't have much of a soul left, but when I say those things, what angers me, just not as an economist and as just like trying to be a decent human being, is I'm blaming everybody, all of us, the consumers, for the outcomes that we're seeing in the market. Mm-hmm. I think it's somewhere in between, right? We have dominant players, right? But we have dominant players that are exploiting people's inability to shop around, right? And so I think that's why you end up often with government policy in this area not pursuing an anti-competitive kind of practices, a lawsuit for collusion. They say, let's inform consumers. Let's give them the data. Let's make the platforms for them. Like, let's, if the disease is, you know, the margins and the symptom is uninformed consumers, let's go after the uninformed consumers and try to help them. I'm not saying it always helps, but okay, that's why we end up not prosecuting anti-competitive behavior.
Can I put to you a dark theory?
Sure.
And I'd love to hear your comment on it.
Okay.
Perhaps government isn't that interested in trying to aggressively pursue the petroleum industry,
okay,
but would like the optics that it was. Because if we have a look at what the government gets out of this industry, it's really to the government's benefit. So they're taking, if you look at a litre of petrol and we break down the cost of a litre of petrol at the bowser, mm-hmm, 50% of that the government legislates that you can afford to the cost of the actual fuel. 12% of it allows for the cost of its distribution and for profit margins.
Yep.
And 38% of it, just until the last budget,
yep,
was government revenue. Mm-hmm. And so before the government temporarily halved their excise on fuel, they were making, just on that 38%, they were making $50 billion over 4 years.
Yeah.
They are absolutely addicted to the revenue from that industry.
Yeah.
Secondly, in my dark theory that
yes,
I want
your dark
you to
theory.
Yes. comment on.
Yeah.
After World War II and through the 50s and the 60s, the government thought, gee, we're an island at the bottom of the world. We're very dependent upon Middle East fuel, petrol.
Yep.
It's incredibly cheap.
Yep.
We need to become self-sufficient. Right. And so all of a sudden, they started throwing money at the petroleum companies, namely BHP and Exxon or Esso.
Yep.
Go out and find some fuel. Go out and find some oil in Australia, which they dutifully did in the Bass right. Strait and the West Australian
yep.
areas.
Yep, yep.
And then, lo and behold, by the year 2000, we were self-sufficient in petrol. Let's talk about petrol, because right. I guess, rather than all the other
sure,
things.
Sure, sure, sure.
And that was terrific. They achieved that objective.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, people felt that they weren't making enough money. Sorry, the fuel companies weren't making enough money.
Yep.
And now we're in the situation where we import a little more than 8 billion litres of petrol per year, mm-hmm. and that we locally refine over 7 billion litres of petrol, but the majority of that comes from imported crude oil.
Yep.
And that allows us motorists the 15.5 billion litres of fuel that we require every year.
Yep.
Now, all of a sudden, mm-hmm. the International Energy Commission says, look, Australia, you're not doing a great job down there because you don't actually have enough fuel to cover your country's needs for more than a small period of time.
Yep.
We believe that you should have enough fuel to cover your needs if
yep.
if we blocked all your shipping lines for yep. 90 days.
Yep.
You're not even close to that.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden the government goes, okay, gee, this is not good. In other words, we're back to 1960.
Right.
And so, okay, short-term effect, what we'll do is these refineries, we'll give them a subsidy. If they fall short of making a reasonable profit margin, we'll give them money. We'll subsidise them. So on the one hand, the government is subsidising exploration, subsidising refining, and taking a massive amount of money in taxes, GST and excise out of fuel.
Yep.
But on the other hand, saying, oh, look at this, we've got some anti-competitive behaviour here. We're going to get the stick out and beat you over the top of the head.
Yeah.
So my dark theory that I want you to comment on is the government seems to be in a very interesting position here because they don't want to scare away the very industry that they rely upon to create self-sufficiency, yet to make themselves politically popular, we'll have the ACCC walk around with a baseball bat and give them a bit of a smack over the back of the head occasionally because it looks good, but really underneath it, we're going to pay out millions and millions and millions of dollars to keep these people happy. What do you think about my dark theory?
There's a lot to unpack in your dark theory. On the surface, it all does sound very circular, right? And let's just break it down into its bits and pieces. On the fuel excise, so that's more of a road user charge than anything else. I think a lot of economists are favorable of fuel excise. It has good properties in the sense that it's a user charge. The more you drive, the more excise you pay. And we use that excise to buy roads and build infrastructure. And so it's a user kind of charge for your use of infrastructure. So it has, so I think the first order sort of usage of fuel excise and its goal is that, not so much just making a war chest of revenue that they're going to, you know, use for a million other things. And it's up to debate and the politicians get into what it gets used for and these sorts of things. But, you know, as a first order issue, it's really about roads and infrastructure. So I think fuel excise, and we have some of the lower fuel excise taxes in the world, actually, relative to comparable countries. So we could, in principle, be even higher on that one, but we're not. So so I'd say that's where the fuel excise fits in, is more about that than it is about anything else in terms of political economy. On energy independence, you know, it's that's kind of now, from a, you know, in terms of academic circles and policy circles, it's really back in style. On the backs of the, you know, the war in Ukraine and all these questions about the independence and all the and the flip side of that, all the interdependencies that has happened across many different markets, including oil markets across the world and especially in Australia, over the, you know, this kind of age of globalization we've come into in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, right? And so, yes, we are now fully dependent on foreign oil. We've gotten away from domestically produced oil. Now that kind of pendulum is swinging back the other way because we've lived through peaceful times where we haven't been threatened in our supply chains in oil for quite some time. And so there's nothing to talk about there. Everything's working fine. When we go offshore and go overseas, you can bring down the cost of oil. The exploration costs are much lower in Saudi Arabia and Russia. That's why they're so dominant. But it's also why they're so dominant and they can hold you up in sort of geopolitical circumstances. And so that risk is always bubbling underneath. But as we've seen with our governments, particularly the current one, they don't tend to head off risks. They tend to react to things after it's already happened. So, you know, we've had multiple different, we've had both Labour and the coalition kind of oversee this sort of offshoring of foreign oil and our growing dependence on foreign oil over time. And so we're coming now back full circle to what you're saying. Are we back in the 60s? We are a little bit, in terms of we've maybe, you know, over-globalized relative to how much risk, you know, we should be taking on in terms of our dependence on foreign oil supplies. So we're seeing that come back the other way. We purchased a ton of oil there in March 2020, April 2020. The federal government bought it, you know, and tried to boost those reserves as the oil markets crashed. In hindsight, that was a good decision. We still are still short relative to, you know, international benchmarks in terms of how much oil we have on shore to deal with emergencies. And that's actually in the United States. So we'd have to wait for it to come over if we needed it. So, you know, people point to that as sort of real concerns about shortfalls. But again, we tend to be so reactionary and not proactive with so much of public policy that, you know, at the end of the day, governments always have this incentive to say, look, we can push prices down offshore, offshore, offshore. It's not so fun to say, hey, everybody, let's pay a bit more to buy our own stuff onshore all the time, but then we don't have to worry about geopolitical risk. If that geopolitical risk is never there for people for 20 years, there's nothing to tell the voters, right? Russia could go to war, and it's like, well, they haven't for 15, 20 years, so why are we still paying this Russia goes to war premium? And so that political tension and that kind of, and then the private kind of tensions boil into that of like, well, we can cut costs if we just offshore it all. Right. And so I think we see this sort of people's desire for cost savings now and underestimating the amount of risk that's out there from being fully dependent on foreign resources and oil that kind of plays out. And now we're kind of coming back the other way because the risk has bubbled up, because it's biting us in the butt now. We're now kind of backtracking and saying, wait a minute, maybe there is something to this energy independence. But if we go back to peaceful times and we do set up all this, you know, domestic oil wholesale supply, and there's peaceful times coming, that pressure will eventually grow. Well, we're post-war. Let's just offshore everything. It's safe now, right? That'll come back up because people really pay a lot more attention to what's right in front of them than the things that could happen in the future.
Okay, so do you think because we're in that situation now, the government would be less zealous in pursuing any anti-competitive actions against petrol wholesale retailers?
They've come out, so in the time of the pandemic, and when oil, particularly when the oil markets collapsed, and we just published a paper on exactly this, I wanted to call the paper the book, like the word of Rod, as in Rod Sims, but my co-authors wouldn't allow me to do it. But basically the ACCC did come out, the stick bashing, oil prices are falling, the economy's crashing, petrol retailers better pass through those falling wholesale costs to people because we're all suffering right now economically, that we need some support. And in that evidence, we did actually see the retailers react to the government announcement. So we are seeing the government being vocal in terms of pass through, you know, on the issue of what we call cost pass through, meaning when costs go down, those prices better come quickly with them, not stay high and then the companies just make a bunch of profit. In terms of anti-competitive behavior, I mean, I think at the current moment, it's probably just not front of mind with the government, with all everything that's currently going on, you know, in various spheres. But in competition policy in particular, I think the thing that's eating up the most resources at the moment with, say, the ACCC is much more about digital issues, Facebook, Google, and these sorts of things.
Okay. Yeah. I've got two questions to ask before we...
Sure.
This is a new question that I'm now going to ask
Okay. Every
one of my experts. In terms of petrol and what we're talking about,
yep.
Why is economics the hero in the story about petrol prices?
So economics really hits its stride when you look at the world and say it's really complicated. And you can try to understand a complicated world by digging into every single detail of everything that happens. And if you do that, you're probably not going to learn anything. Economics is really good at taking something complicated, petrol price cycles. They look insane when you look at a graph. There's tons of data. And it's really good at disciplining somebody to say, what are the few things that really matter here? Out of all the possible things that are going on in the real world, what are the core issues that are driving kind of how prices are being set in the market and how consumers are behaving in the market? And I've heard 17,000 different things thrown at me about petrol prices. And at the end of the day, economics is the hero because it's able to really, through a combination of economic theory and then empirical evidence to sort of test and test our theories in the real world, to say, you know, yeah, there's a lot going on. There's a million things going on that affect oil markets and prices at the Bowser. But when I want to think about anti-competitive behavior, I think it really boils down to, you know, consumers' inability to shop, that they're busy, people are busy. I think that's a core force driving what we see. And big players' ability to understand they're a big player. And then if they do stuff, others follow. And if they all mutually understand that we just do this, then we'll set prices like this, right? That we'll coordinate together. And I think those two real facets, which come from economic theory, and then I get the rich data to discipline and say, like, if I can understand those two things, I can get a lot of this story. Economics provides structure and insight in a world of chaos to help us sort of understand where we're going and what we may or may not be able to do about it. That's why it's the hero.
My last question, The Bergenomics test.
Yep.
We've got the simple hamburger.
Right.
How can you apply
yep.
your competitive pricing situation that you and Professor DeRouze
yep.
wrote the paper at? How would you apply that to a hamburger?
Okay, so it's takeaway food, tends to be a weekend type of food, it is for me at least. Most people who commute, most Australians, you gotta fill your tank every week. And your market, your petrol market is say like, because of coordinated behavior, you're getting like 5 cents per liter higher prices than you otherwise should get. So you filled up your petrol tank, it's 50 liters, 55 liters, your Toyota Camry. And so first of all, you've paid $2.50 more to fill up your burger. Now, suppose you're going to Macca's. Okay, so now you got you're going to feed the family. You can buy one less burger, right? Because it's cost you more to fill up at the tank. That $2.50 you can no longer to buy that burger with. So you've just lost a burger. And then you show up at Macca's, and everything's 10, 20, 30 cents more expensive. Whoa. Okay, but I've already lost a burger because it's more expensive because they've increased the prices on me. Why is this happening? Yeah, well, we had to ship it here. Guess what? That took petrol, and we're paying those higher prices because of that as well. And you're like, okay, fine, I guess so. The meat had to come, the grains had to come, the buns had to come, so I'm going to pay for that. Is that enough? No. Suzanne, who's serving you, she had to drive here too. Guess what? She paid $2.50 more for petrol too. So her wages need to be a bit higher to compensate for that kind of market power driven price growth. So we got to pay her too. So now not only can you buy you can buy one less burger because you're filling up more, but the burgers you can buy are more expensive because the products that go into them and the people that serve you to them are also more expensive. So you're paying more there as well.
Fantastic. Professor David Byrne, thank you very much for explaining the dynamics of the petrol market in Australia to us. I think it's fascinating. I think there are going to be many of our listeners that will be sitting nodding their head the whole time they're listening to you. Perhaps they believe economists and other people, maybe within government, are all got the same view to support a system that they feel in their gut something's not working correctly. You've said through what we talked about today, well, it's certainly working in a much different way than what other markets would work, and you've proved that empirically. So thank you very much.
Very welcome, and apologize for blaming everybody for being too busy to shop when I had to be the bad cop there mid chat. But it's tricky, but with data and evidence, we can kind of move the needle just a bit, hopefully every paper by paper and interaction with government and these companies.
Thank you very much. My thanks for today's podcast to Melbourne University Professor of Economics, David Byrne. If you want to read Professors Byrne and DeRue's study on Australian petrol pricing and deep dive into other reading Professor Byrne recommends relating to Australian petrol pricing, please check the deep dive section in the show notes of this podcast or visit the Bergonomics website. Professor Byrne is passionate that all motorists start using apps to find the cheapest petrol near where they live. These apps are also listed. I'm also interested in your suggestions for topics you would like our experts to discuss, so please email them to me at ross@bergonomicspodcast.com.au. My thanks also to Ology Creative, who provide Bergonomics with design excellence, and Suzanne Tonks, who heads up Bergonomics PR agency, Oliver & York. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to the Bergonomics podcast. That way we know you like our topics. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and TikTok.